more vaccine and more vaccination sites are opening up. And this week, more people in our area are also eligible to get those shots. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, everything you need to know today about the new vaccination sites and rules opening up across the city. Get on the line now with your thoughts and questions, 549-2937. Then later, we'll tell you why advocates for an economic concept gaining traction say that COVID relief bill won't break our bank. All about MMT, or modern monetary theory. First this hour, though, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The state reports the number of coronavirus cases ticked up yesterday by about 1,700. We are above 1.9 million cumulative cases in the state. Active hospitalizations went up nearly by 4,000, and deaths rose again overnight to 30,999. Now, here's another number. More than 3 million Florida residents have now had at least one dose of vaccine. And speaking of vaccines, both the number of places doling them out around town and the categories of people eligible to receive the shots are expanding this week. Some good news. Chad Nielsen is Director of Accreditation and Infection Prevention at UF Health Jacksonville, and he is on the line now to update us all. Hi, Chad. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
It's always great to have your insights on this show. And here's our question to callers. Have you been vaccinated? Are you waiting for your turn to be vaccinated? What are your questions about who's eligible and where you can go to be vaccinated? There are new places, new opportunities to get your shot this week here in Jacksonville and surrounding areas. So give us a call. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. So, Chad, let's talk about what's new. Two big things. They've expanded at the Regency Mall site the categories of people who are eligible to be vaccinated. And there's a new federal site at the Gateway Town Center that is up and running. Can you begin by talking about the Regency site, which has been operating for some time? Who's eligible now to be vaccinated there?
Yeah, so it's a great question. There's a lot of differing dynamics about who runs the site and what qualifications are there. So at this point now at the Regency Center, they have changed some of their criteria in order to include folks who are first responders, teachers, and those who are 50 years or older and fall into those categories, which is a change. Before, it was very strict 65 and up, but now at Regency, if you're a teacher or law enforcement or firefighter and you're 50 and up, you can now get qualified to get a vaccination there.
Teacher, law enforcement, or firefighter age 50 and up, go to the Regency Mall. You do have an appointment. You have to have an appointment, Chad, although sometimes they're asking people to come with no appointment, which makes me wonder if they have a lot of unused doses. They're just trying to make sure get used.
Yeah, they could have excess doses that maybe resulted because people didn't make their appointment time or they were held up and couldn't come. So always watch what the news agencies are saying in terms of extra appointments available, because frequently they will put out either Twitter news or something through the local radio stations to say, hey, come on down, we've got more.
Okay, let's talk about the other site that has opened this week. This is run by the federal government, and it is at the Gateway Town Center. This also has satellite sites, one in Northwest Jacksonville at the Hammond Senior Center, one on the west side at the Normandy Community Center on Lindsay Road. Can you tell us, what are the procedures for the Gateway Mall vaccination site?
Yeah, so the Gateway Mall, these are FEMA-based sites. There is a portal in order for people to access to sign up for that. Because it's a FEMA, basically a federally run site, there's slightly different processes with that one. You still have to be in a certain age group over it. And that's why it's really important that people look into this before they start heading to those sites, because a federal site has different qualifying criteria than state sites, and that's important to understand. But for the FEMA Gateway site, they are still focusing on seniors, those 65 years of age or older, and those sign-up portals are available as they get updated.
And apparently that site opens officially tomorrow. High-risk Florida residents can now be vaccinated at places like Publix and others under the governor's order. Let's talk about that category, because I know that quite a few people under age 65 have been waiting patiently for months to be vaccinated because they're immunocompromised in some way, Chad.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So now, per the governor's order, folks who are deemed a high-risk category can now get vaccinated at some of these other sites, whether it be a pharmacy or a Walgreens or a Walmart. So they're starting to set up what that looks like, but the way it looks to be planned is that a physician will fill out a form that will be a state form saying, yes, this is my patient. He or she has this qualifying comorbidity or qualifying condition, and therefore I believe they should get vaccinated. And once the physician fills out that form, puts their stamp on it, you would be able to theoretically take that to a Walgreens or a Walmart and get signed up to take the vaccine if you are over 50.
There's also a site we need to note at Edward Waters College, along with all the other sites we've been talking about for some time, including at public stores, pharmacies, and some hospitals. Chad, let's talk about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. When do you anticipate this product being available in Florida and being going into arms?
Yeah, so actually, according to the governor's office, there's about 175,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that are headed to Florida and could be here by the end of the week. And versus the other vaccines, because the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a one-shot dose, that 175 shots, that's 175,000 people that can get vaccinated. So fingers crossed it gets here by the end of the week and we can start setting that up and sending it out to the community sites that we have here for the state of Florida by next week.
This is all good news. And as an infection prevention specialist, you must be feeling pretty good after a very long, hard slog. This is all positive news, Chad, and it's good to be able to report it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely seeing a turn in this pandemic. Not only are hospital numbers stabilizing, we're seeing the number of new cases not explode at the rate that we have in the past. And now we have a third effective vaccine coming to market. That's also dovetailed by the news that the Pfizer vaccine is going to have differing storage standards, which make it more available for different types of offices and clinics to carry it. So we're really moving in the right direction. We just have to really urge the public that if you can get the shot, no matter what brand it is, get the shot, and let's continue to build on the progress we're making.
Let's go to your calls now. 549-2937. What are your questions about the changing picture when it comes to opportunities to be vaccinated here in Florida? 549-2937. Mark in Riverside. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to make the comment that the Lake City VA hospital is giving the vaccine to folks of any age as long as you have one risk factor. And no appointment, at least they were doing it last week. I don't know if they're still doing it. But I was able to go, took me 10 minutes, got the vaccine, and it was a really easy process.
Okay, thanks for that. Chad, that's good to hear. Let's talk about the veteran population and what they need to be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. With the veteran population, which I'm particularly sensitive to being an active member of the Air National Guard, we definitely want to encourage them to get vaccinated if they're offered the shot. I know that the VA and the Department of Defense has a variety of options available to get our veterans vaccinated, no matter what their age, and I urge people to look into that further. The VA and DOD websites have a lot of information on how veterans can get access to their shots.
549-2937. Ricky on the north side. Hello, Ricky.
Good morning. How you all doing?
All right, thanks. How are you?
Just great. I'm kind of right off the last veteran. I'm a veteran, and I know veterans that still authorized, you know, they certified to give shots. And I made a suggestion to one of our state house members that if, you know, we get like 100 vials, you know, that we could go around and set up in neighborhoods on the north side where I'm at, which is underserved, And we could do like 100 people, you know, like that guy said, we could do like 100 people in about 3 hours. But I didn't ever get any feedback from anyone up there. So I don't know whether they just doing their own thing over here or look like to me, they should want all the help that they could get. You know?
Sure. Thanks, Ricky. Chad, let's talk about underserved communities in Jacksonville and elsewhere, because Governor Ron DeSantis has come under criticism for seemingly to provide the vaccination opportunities to white and wealthy communities first, rather than poor and minority communities first. I want to get your thoughts about that, particularly since you sit at U of Health Jacksonville and you are the region's safety net hospital. What about this?
Yeah, I certainly think it was a mistake by the state to prioritize anybody other than the underserved population and those in these essential worker populations. And I think that what you're seeing when that media backlash occurred is now a reset of what the state is prioritizing. And so obviously UF Health Jacksonville serves a very vulnerable community. So it's always been in our interest to get vaccines and get healthcare resources to the most underserved in Jacksonville, and that's what our goal has been from the start. So it's a nice reset now that we have to get these vaccines into Northwest Jacksonville and the other areas that need it the most. And per that caller, I do know there's at least one largely veteran-run organization, Team Rubicon, is working up at the Yulee area doing vaccinations, and so certainly any kind of suggestions that that veterans can help in this fight are well taken, and I know at least one nonprofit organization is working to do that, and usually another vulnerable population given their lack of resources.
Yeah, certainly. 549-2937. Holly in St. Augustine. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple of questions, and those are... Why don't we have some kind of pre-sign-up for people where, you know, it's based on your birth date, and then when that group opens up, we already have a predetermined list of people to, you know, make appointments for. And then secondly, airlines always overbook, and that seems to work for them, so they maximize those flights. Why aren't we doing something like that?
Sure.
And I'll take it off the air. Thanks so much.
I know, Holly. And, you know, getting back to what I was saying, Chad, Governor DeSantis has faced criticism for not providing more of a roadmap for when we can all expect to have our turn next. What about that kind of framework, either by birthday or just by the decade, you know, decades, you know, by this date, people age 50 to 60, everyone will be eligible and so forth. Other states have done that.
Yeah, and so most of our distribution plans should be based off of the CDC. We've had plans for how to distribute vaccines for a pandemic for years, literally decades. This goes into the National Emergency Management Safety Network and how we do this as a framework as a country. Unfortunately, states, or fortunately in some cases, have done it different than what the National Strategic Plan should have been. You see that Florida has prioritized different groups versus other states, and largely that's because the governors of each state can either accept the national framework of how to do this or not. The other thing that makes this really difficult is that we know versus just doing a flat rollout of, you know, if you're 50, come on this date or rolling out like that, is we know that COVID-19 affects certain ages and comorbidities different. We knew that nursing home populations were most vulnerable and likely should have gotten the shot first, regardless of how old they were, because that's where the majority of deaths in our state were happening. So there is allowable to have some tweak to what populations get this vaccine. But I understand the concern, and I echo it, that we've done our own thing here in Florida versus other states, and sometimes it doesn't always make sense.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Chad Nielsen of U of Health Jacksonville, updating everyone about vaccinations. It's 549-2937. with about 175,000 doses of the newly approved Johnson & Johnson vaccine coming to Florida this week, the governor signed an executive order Monday. It expands vaccinations in the state to school personnel, law enforcement, and firefighters 50 years old and older. So if you're a K through 12 teacher in law enforcement or a firefighter, you are now eligible to make an appointment and be vaccinated. There is a FEMA-run site opening at the Gateway Mall officially tomorrow that will be vaccinating these groups. The Regency Mall site has announced it is updating the criteria. So again, these are the people who are now eligible. Firefighters, sworn law enforcement, and K through 12 school employees age 50 and up. Healthcare personnel with direct patient contact. People age 65 and older. And long-term care facility residents and staff. Lots of tweets coming in. Here's one from Angie. Meanwhile, grocery workers like me are surrounded by people who don't wear masks and they won't distance. The opposite side of me is happy that more deserving people are finally getting the shot. Another tweet about grocery store workers from a listener. He says, our grocery store workers deserve to be prioritized for vaccinations, not only because they've risked their lives for us over the past year, but because they're in contact with all of us, and protecting them protects us all. One more tweet for you, Chad. Jason tweets the show, between the Regency site, the public sites, it seems they could do first responders and teachers of all ages. Okay, so what do you think about all of this feedback, Chad? Grocery workers, and is there enough supply to expand the circle wider?
Yeah. So the short answer is probably not yet. There's probably not enough supply of vaccines coming into the state yet to expand the circles. That being the case, there certainly is a great argument for vaccinating essential workers, no matter their age, right? Why does it matter if a firefighter is 50 or not when they're seeing the same types of patients in the field than a 51-year-old would in their 25? So I certainly think that some of these restrictions are probably too stringent, but that probably has to do with the supply of vaccines that we're getting into the states. We know that the federal government has expanded their purchasing of vaccinations, and I think by probably as early as June, you're going to start seeing enough vaccine for nearly all Floridians. We just have to wait patiently to that point. But I certainly share in that that concern that essential workers of all kinds, no matter their age, should be a vulnerable population, should be offered the vaccine if we have those doses.
549-2937, Gary in Jacksonville. Hello, Gary.
Hi. My question is the state or the government keeping some type of database where you can actually access who are getting these shots, whether they've gotten the first shot, the second shot, or what have you. And so whoever has the need to know can access this database if need be.
Okay. Tracking who's been vaccinated, Chad.
Yeah, so there is a database here for the state of Florida. It's called Florida Shots. Anybody who receives a COVID vaccine in the state of Florida, their Florida shot record is automatically updated, and that's something that is used by healthcare providers across the state and has been for decades. So when somebody asks you for your vaccine records or when your children has a vaccine record that they need to get for school, it goes through what's called Florida Shots. And so the short answer is yes, it's all tracked. We know how many people have gotten that vaccine because it's input into Florida Shots. We know who they are, where they live. We have all of that information at the state level.
And as you track all this information, you mentioned a minute ago that there have been some lessons learned, particularly when it comes to long-term care facilities, that population. What else have you and other infectious disease specialists, like, what have you learned throughout this process? What have been the biggest takeaways?
Yeah, so I think some of the biggest takeaways is really we have a better idea of who's really severely affected by this virus and who's not. We know who's more likely to spread it and who's not. And so based on that information, we know that those individuals who are 65 years and up are more likely to get severe COVID and or potentially die from it. So that enables us to target that population who are most vulnerable. We also know about demographics. We know that minorities are more likely, for a variety of reasons, to suffer disproportionately from this virus. So we want to get the vaccine out for that. We also know who's more likely to spread it. It's not 65-year-olds. It's going to be college students or 30s or 40s. They're the most likely population to spread it. So by targeting some of that population for vaccination, that could be really helpful in also stopping transmission. So those big takeaways are really we have a better idea of who this virus affects, who spreads it, and that enables us to target some of these interventions with vaccines, where to put these sites, and how to move forward.
Jay in Jacksonville. Hi, Jay. Good morning, Jay. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
I just wanted to make a comment. If you ride through Jacksonville on I-10, 295, 95, even county roads, state roads, all the construction workers that you see out there working on bridges and roadways, according to the state of Florida, we're all considered essential workers. And there has, as far as I can tell, there's never been any comment on any of these people being essential workers, and nobody said anything about whether or not, when are they going to get the vaccine, unless it's, you know, due to your age or any, you know, diabetes or anything like that. When will they be able to get it? Because as far as I can tell, you don't get tested unless something happens. Other than that, there's not a real big push for anybody to get the vaccine if you work in bridge and roadway, unless you're above the age of 65 or 50.
Right, Jay. Sorry to hear that. And I appreciate you calling in. You know, Chad, so many people out there are doing hard, difficult work. They are at some risk and they're being really patient, waiting their turn. And it's been very challenging for so many Florida residents.
Yeah, and he's right. We can extend the term essential workers out to so many different types of job classes, whether that's construction workers, postal workers, grocery store employees. I mean, there's even an argument for people like Amazon and UPS drivers because so many stores were closed early on in this pandemic, and those delivery folks were out there doing the most amount of work. It can extend out to meatpacking facilities or any number of essential workers out there. And so I think that this vaccine rollout up until this point has been chaotic because of the lack of supply and the lack of logistics in getting this vaccine out to these folks. But hopefully now that you're seeing more and more vaccination sites opening and an expansion of the criteria of who can get the vaccine, that will continue to improve. We can only just wait and watch.
Sissy in St. Augustine. Hi, Sissy.
Hello?
Go ahead.
I always had a question about home health care. There are thousands of people that are cared for in their home that are bedridden, that are seen by home health care nurses and aides, and there's no way that they can get the vaccine. So I'm real concerned. It's almost like, you know, they target nursing homes, I understand, but these are elderly people who are cared for at home that need the shot.
Of course.
What's the plan for them?
What's the plan for them? Thanks for that. They are certainly frontline workers too, Chad.
Yeah, so home health care workers, and I can speak from our own organization, most home health care workers fall under some kind of company or category that would make them eligible to get a shot as direct patient care staff. Even some of these other sites like Walgreens and Walmart are offering vaccination to frontline healthcare workers. As for the home healthcare patients, that's an interesting population that is not traditionally reached easily. I know our hospital and many others who have home health type services are working on plans to actually get vaccines to the homes through our home health care workers. But that caller's right. It's a very vulnerable population that we certainly don't want to overlook.
Okay, so if you need a ride, by the way, to either the Regency Mall site or the new site at the Gateway Town Center, you can go to jtafla.com and book a free ride, or you can call them at 679-4555. It's their Rides to Health service, free rides to get a vaccine. Chad Nielsen at UF Health Jacksonville. Always so good to get your insights. Thanks so much for updating us.
Yeah, very welcome, and thanks for having me on. We enjoy educating the public as best we can at UF Health.
Thanks so much. And more at our website, too, today about all of this at wjct.org. Much more still ahead, meanwhile, here on this show. Later, a conversation with Duval muralist Jason Tetlack about his new artwork. But up next.
It's a recognition of the fact that since 1971, we have not been linking our currency to a commodity.
We'll tell you why supporters of the rising economic theory called MMT say the COVID relief bill is worth the spending. That's next.
In celebration of Henry Louis Gates Jr.'s new documentary, The Black Church, WJCT is collecting stories and memories of your experiences. What does the Black Church mean to you? What role has it played in your life? Share your thoughts and memories and have your stories archived for future generations. Visit wjct.org/blackchurch for instructions.
BritBox and PBS Passport are now offering the best of all your favorite British drama, comedy, and more when you sign up at jacksbundle.com. Start watching today.
Anthology Turntable Tuesday can now be heard at noon and 9 p.m. every Tuesday on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. Join us for music from vinyl on Anthology Turntable Tuesday, part of WJCT's Jacksonville Music Experience.
In Montana, a college student gathers up his belongings, keys, wallet, phone, and his gun.
You're not looking for a fight, but you're willing to finish it.
A new law will allow him to carry that firearm on campus, and that concerns some other students.
Just the thought of someone having a gun in the dining hall when I'm just trying to eat a sandwich in the morning, that's scary.
Will schools push back? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow, starting at 5 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Connectable Jacks this week launched a new initiative called Shopability. It's designed to celebrate local businesses that employ people with autism, Down syndrome, and other intellectual and developmental differences. They even unveiled a new interactive map so you can find these businesses in your neighborhood. Now you can put that map to use this Saturday for the first ever Shopability event. It's a citywide celebration encouraging all of us to shop and support businesses on the map and learn more about how Jacksonville is at the forefront of IDD inclusion. Sarah Troop is the director of Connectable Jacks, and she told me more. Hey, Sarah, thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, let's talk about Shopability Saturday coming up this Saturday, March 6th. This is part of the Connectable Movement. So what's on the agenda?
Well, Shopability Saturday is a citywide celebration of inclusive employers. We are inviting our whole community to shop or support businesses that choose to see the abilities of people with autism, Down syndrome, and other intellectual and developmental differences, and just celebrate their contributions in the workplace.
And you're even making a map, aren't you, that helps people find these businesses?
Yes. We have a map of close to 150 businesses across Jacksonville that employ or provide internship opportunities for people with intellectual and developmental differences, or IDDs, and it's at connectablejacks.com.
Okay. And so to make it onto your list, as you said, these have to be local businesses that either employ people or do other things to support this community. How do you determine who qualifies?
Well, Connectable unites many nonprofits, businesses, and individuals in shining a spotlight on the contributions of people with intellectual and developmental differences in our lives and in our community, and help spark connections. So these businesses have partnered with many of the nonprofits who are united through Connectable and hosting the Shopability event. They either provide employment, internships, or serve as a job site in partnership with a nonprofit.
Okay. And how do you encourage businesses to employ people with intellectual and developmental differences, IDDs, as you say? How does that work? Because I would think there would have to be an education process involved and talking to a business owner about how these folks can be such great employees.
Yes. We try to really raise awareness about how people with intellectual and developmental differences just bring value, diversity, and a new perspective to teams. And 84% of employers report that these are highly dependable individuals. And it supports workplace culture, and consumers like this too. So there are so many nonprofits in our community that can help work with businesses, help them identify suitable work in their organization, find an employee, and then just provide all of the onboarding and job coaching. And this is a service that is of no cost to businesses or the job applicants when they are enrolled in a service called vocational rehab.
With all of that said, you want to encourage everyone to take part in Shopability Saturday this Saturday. How can they do that?
Participants can go to connectablejacks.com and search the interactive map, and they can find businesses ranging from restaurants to retail to entertainment and more. There's something for everyone. And so we just invite them to go in person or maybe take out, curbside pickup, or online, and shop and support these businesses. We even have a fun social media contest that we'll be running for people who want to take pictures and share it on social media. For my family, I have 3 kids and 3 schools, and this is our first day of spring break. Mm-hmm. So we're going to kick off our spring break staycation. I'm letting each kid pick a business on the map. I think so far we're up to Firehouse Subs, Brewster's Ice Cream, maybe Mosh or the Zoo. We're still debating. Maybe we'll do both. There's just really something for everyone, and it's just a great way to support these businesses and show people with intellectual and developmental differences that they are valued and included in our community.
What a great thing to do. Everybody check it out at ConnectableJacks.com and support Shopability this Saturday, March 6th. Support one of these businesses. They are across the area, and she is Sarah Troop, director at Connectable. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. Have a good day.
You too. Well, President Biden's COVID relief package has passed the House. Some Republicans in the Senate are expected to raise objections to its huge price tag. They argue it will increase the deficit and that the country can't afford it. Yet supporters of a rising economic theory called MMT disagree. For more on modern monetary theory, I spoke with Daniel Cronrath of FSCJ. Take a listen. Hey, Daniel. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
You know, in recent years, people have heard about MMT, modern monetary theory, but people don't know what it is or why they should even need to know about it and why it could be helpful to all of us. Can you begin by explaining what is modern monetary theory?
Sure. Modern monetary theory, or MMT, has been something which has been developed by a group of macroeconomics economists over the last 20 years, Melissa. And what it really is this: it's a recognition of the fact that since 1971, we have not been linking our currency to a commodity. The U.S. dollar is, in effect, what we call fiat currency, which means it's basically its value is assigned to that by our central bank in the United States, which is the Fed. And what this does is it really gives us the ability to unlock unlock an incredible amount of economic prowess within our economy that we've never really thought about doing, because all of us conventionally are still kind of stuck in a lot of the other economic ways of thinking, the economic schools, whether it be Keynesian or whether it be the Chicago School, of course, with Milton Friedman. And we have this in the back of our mind that somehow our currency is still tied to a gold standard. And in reality, for the last 50 years, it hasn't been.
Yeah. And so we still, though, have these puritanical ideas in our American minds, though, about having, for example, a balanced budget, that's important. But modern monetary theory, basically, it throws that out the window. Is modern monetary theory a license to just keep printing more money?
No, certainly not. You know, a lot of people say, oh, well, if basically you're saying that the United States has a sovereign currency and that we can print as much money as we want, then why don't we just do that? And the answer is inflation. I mean, certainly, regardless of the fact that the U.S. is what we call the only currency issuer. Okay, you, myself, Bill Gates, the state of Florida, the city of Jacksonville, we are what we refer to as currency users, and that currency is actually manufactured by the United States government. It is the only currency issuer. So when we get our minds wrapped around things like debt and deficit, and we end up becoming so concerned, and we use phrases like, oh, well, China owns our debt, or how will our children pay our debt? Well, this is 180-degree opposite thinking. We can't run out of money. We are the U.S. government is the only issuer of the currency. So to your point, what is the only fear then? Why don't we just print unlimited amounts of money? Well, it's inflation. We don't want to print so much money as that we devalue our currency to the point where it's worthless.
Mm-hmm. So then how would modern monetary theory work if we were to actually implement it in real life?
Right. Well, in some ways, we're already doing it. You know, modern monetary theory is more of it's actually more of a description of what we're already doing than some sort of theory. And if you just think about some of the economics here in the United States since the Great Recession, you know, the U.S. national debt right now is at $26.9 trillion. Under President Obama, we added $8.7 trillion in debt. Under President Trump in his 4 years, $6.7 trillion of debt. Our deficit in the first year of Joe Biden, not our debt, mind you, but just our deficit, is projected to be $2.3 trillion next year in 2021, this year. So what you're basically saying and what we're seeing is that, wow, we are racking up all of this debt, but we're not seeing the runaway inflation that classically trained economists would tell us is going to happen. We're not seeing our dollars becoming devalued. And what we need to understand is that what we should be doing, the things that we really want to pay for in this country, the things which are important to future generations. I know yourself, you know, you've been a strong advocate for climate change, and for you've done a lot of programming with your listeners and talking about how do we make Jacksonville sustainable. Well, this is very, very important to get at, because what we need to be reminded of is that not every government certainly has the ability just to print its own currency. The city of Jacksonville, the state of Florida, they are currency users. They are dependent upon the federal government to answer the big challenges which are going to be coming forward in future generations. To ask ourselves, how are we going to provide affordable health care coverage to every single American? How are we going to get ready for climate change? How are we going to get out of this pandemic and at some point future economic challenges that we have in this country? And the answer is that the federal government has the ability to help us do that because they are the sole issuer of money.
But this is, so far at least, not a winning political argument. And how do you see the political discussion going forward over modern monetary theory?
Well, and that's really it, Melissa, and that's one of the reasons why I was so happy that you had me on today, is that we need to really start educating our citizenry to the power that we have trapped in our own economy, okay? We have the ability to do great things, but we need to develop that political will, which isn't just coming from our elected officials, but it's also coming from you and me. The average American needs to understand that our government budget is not a household budget. The Ross family, the Cronrath household, we don't have the ability to go into our basement and legally make tender. Okay, we could. We would be arrested. Mm. The only entity that has that ability is the United States government. So we need to uncouple our thinking, first of all, as Americans, and say, you know what? you know, we do have to be worried about debt and deficit. We will eventually have to pay down our credit card debt or our student loans. But the U.S. government never has that fear. The only fear the United States government has in issuing currency is inflation. When our dollars, and this is antithetical to most people's way of thinking when they think about, my goodness, you know, how are we going to deal with this debt and deficit? Listen, as of right now, the debt in Japan, which also has its own sovereign currency, Japanese national debt is now 1.12 quadrillion yen. Quadrillion. Mm. And yet the Japanese economy has been humming along for the last 20 years. Slow rates of growth, but consistent rates of growth with all kinds of improvements in their economy relative to their per capita earnings, very, very almost negative interest rates, and no inflation. So it's not so much that MMT or modern monetary theory is the way that things is or the way that we should be doing things. It's actually the conditions that we have. Recognizing it is what is going to unlock our ability to provide for future generations.
Let me throw a wrinkle into this discussion. How do you see the rise of Bitcoin interacting with modern monetary theory? Because if we all accept that money is pretend, is it, and that in the end, debt is a concept rather than a hard reality, as we see in a household budget, how does Bitcoin play into that?
Well, I think that Bitcoin and any of the other cryptocurrencies which are out there are only going to really factor in the equation as long as they still attach their value to the U.S. dollar, okay? As long as they are still at the end of the day coming back and saying that the amount of Bitcoin that you have is still worth this much in U.S. dollars, then both systems should be able to function simultaneously. Now, at some point in the future, you know, it could very well be plausible that you, me, others, individuals who accept Bitcoin, we could certainly be conducting trade. We could be conducting commercial transactions aside from U.S. currency. If, again, every user of Bitcoin or of that cryptocurrency accepted the fact that this does in fact have this value, this intrinsic value, which, again, is backed by nothing other than that you and I both find worth in what it is we're exchanging.
Hmm. Fascinating. Where can people go to learn more about MMT?
Yeah, sure. I would. The number one book, which has kind of become the layperson's Bible for MMT, is a wonderful little book that was written by an economist at Stony Brook University. Her name is Stephanie Kelton. It's a New York Times bestseller, and it was called The Deficit Myth. You can also find a whole host of videos on YouTube or other search internet sites, which she will really, really go through and explain the basics of modern monetary theory. And she really tries to educate. The one thing that makes Professor Kelton so wonderful is that she's not just an economist, but she's also one of the most practiced teachers that I think I've seen recently in the economics field. So I would start there. There's a variety of other podcasts you can find out there, one called Macro and Cheese, a little play on mac and cheese, which is another great place that folks can educate themselves. But that was really the purpose that I'm really glad you let me have the opportunity to talk to you today, was the whole idea that we need to start educating ourselves about the power that we have in our economy.
Daniel Cronrath, always good to get your insights. Thanks.
Thanks, Melissa.
And in a moment, a conversation with Duval muralist Jason Tetlack on the power of public art and his new work that you can see from your morning commute. We'll tell you all about it next. We'll be right back.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Actor Jared Leto talks with us about his eerie role in the crime drama The Little Things. Leto initially had misgivings about his performance.
I remember after the first take, I thought, wow, I just really blew it. This is terrible. I've ruined the movie, and I have to help them find a new person for the part.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
A Reddit army versus Wall Street hedge funds made for some splashy headlines, yes, and Hollywood is hoping it's going to be a hit on the big screen.
Some were, you know, contrarian investment advisors who went up against these big guys. I think there's a David and Goliath story here, but it really is about the people.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the race to make the first GameStop movie, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
President Trump imposed sanctions on members of the International Criminal Court for investigating possible U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. Many advocates want the sanctions removed.
I don't need the Biden administration to love the fact that U.S. actors are being investigated, but what I do want to see is my government not obstructing justice.
Undoing the sanctions, though, could be tricky. That's on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
What impact has the last year had on America's youngest minds? Parents, teachers, and politicians are all worried about how the current educational upheaval will affect K-12 students. The consequences could last a lifetime. I'm Jen White. How do we help those whose development has been disrupted? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville-based muralist Jason Tetlack has finished painting a new mural. It's on the rooftop of the River Park Place office building at 751 Oak Street in Riverside, and it's a bit of a welcome sign to travelers, depicting dynamic scenes of local wildlife and the St. Johns River ecosystem. Now, this is really cool. You can see it if you're commuting across the Fuller Warren Bridge. See it from your vehicle. Jason is on the line now to tell us more. Good morning.
Good morning.
And this is exciting. It's always great to talk about new public art going up around town. Tell us about this new work you just completed.
Yeah, like you mentioned, it's on the rooftop right next to the Fuller Warren Bridge, and it's kind of serving as a de facto welcome sign to people coming down Interstate 95. And it's something that I really wanted to, like, help brighten up the city and create something of a landmark to kind of introduce Jacksonville as a city that supports public art.
So if you're driving north on I-95 coming right through Jacksonville, should you look to the left to see it or look to the right?
To the left.
Look directly to your left. Okay. And it's a wildlife and river scene. So lots of blues and greens, I take it, and that kind of thing?
It's really brightly colored, so it's not a traditional landscape type of a painting.
Okay.
And I actually treated it sort of like four different murals because it encompasses the full rooftop of the building. So there are four walls. The wall you see coming southbound on 95 says Jacks, Florida, and has some welcoming colors and sun rays and some wave icons and things like that. And then the other side of the building is more representative of the beaches with a surfer and some sea turtles. And there's even a wall that faces more of the neighborhood that represents Five Points with some icons of ducks because there's a very popular duck pond park there. So it's really four small murals together, and they kind of all work together to create this really bright, eye-catching design.
Now, you're known for this. You're known for your bold, colorful pieces. You did a Bill Murray mural in the entrance to Murray Hill that got a lot of acclaim. You've had your murals featured at Art Basel in Miami and cities around the country. You even did a giant 3D mural of the Beastie Boys on Park Street, which got you a Guinness World Record. So you like to go big and bold, right?
I do. And you know, driving around, I see lots of blank walls that are just gray or khaki, and it really drives me crazy. And I just want to put something there that's eye-catching and colorful to kind of brighten up the world we live in, and especially with this mural, like, people going over the Fuller Warren Bridge are typically stuck in traffic and maybe on their way to work. And I just like to give things that are really bright and colorful to people that maybe will brighten their day a little bit.
So every time, that's so funny to hear you talk. When you see a blank wall, all you can think is, I must cover that wall with paint, right?
Yeah. And once you start seeing blank walls, you see them everywhere.
I can't let you come over here. We've got some very big outside walls at WJCT that I know you could brighten up, but I'm sure there would be a long bureaucratic process. So
Yeah. That's a part of doing a mural, actually. There's a whole lot of work that goes in beforehand. Like, people will see me out painting a wall for a week, but they don't realize that there's maybe 3 or 4 months of work beforehand, getting approvals and working on design. So public art is not just a couple of days that you see somebody out there painting. There's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that go on.
Once you get through that whole minefield and you actually create the public art, how do you see public art adding vibrancy to a community like this one? Because we've seen an explosion of it in recent years.
Yeah, and it really helps the local economy too. Neighborhoods like Murray Hill, where I first started out, have really seen lots of new businesses and residential growth, because you're creating a more welcoming space, a little happier place. If you're driving through a neighborhood and everything's gray and run down, you have a sort of a feeling that you don't even recognize. But once you see places with bright colors and pretty pictures all over the place, it's more welcoming, and it's a place you want to spend more time. And businesses recognize that, and they come into those neighborhoods, and it really transforms a space. So it's really great to see so many great public artists in Jacksonville helping make the community just a much prettier place to live.
Well, now that you've finished this one, which is sort of a welcome sign for the city, what's next on your agenda?
I actually have plans to go to Texas, and I'm doing that next month to paint an animal shelter outside of Austin, and I'm going to be going to Miami next month and possibly Denver this summer.
Busy guy. Well, Jason, yeah. Kudos to you on all the success. Look for Jason's new mural as you're coming along I-95 North and you cross the Fuller Warren Bridge. Look for it to your left. You'll see it on a rooftop, sort of a welcoming sign for people passing into town. Muralist Jason Tetlack, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, Director Josh Torres, News Director Jessica Palumbo, and Digital Editor Bill Bortsfield. Plus all of your feedback. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, our podcast will be up later today wherever you like to listen. You can always also listen through the WJCT app. Download that. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. And we'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.